It's time for our monthly media segment, Signals and Noise. One thing we've noticed about running a monthly media segment at this time in history is the topics come really fast. We can try to lock them up a few days in advance, but the fire hose of news frequently shuffles us right up until the last minute. And in fact, it happened again just a moment ago as I was informed of a news story. But that's okay. There's always plenty to talk about. And we do define media very broadly, taking in items about the media themselves and content delivered over a broad range of media, from virtual reality to books. Our regular guests are here from the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. Precious Yamaguchi, hi again.
Hi, good morning.
And Andrew Gay, good to see you both back here.
Thank you very much.
So let us start with one of the major events that happened since you were last here, which is the shooting at the high school in Florida. And I want to be clear that I'm not trying to minimize anything about the concerns of the students or the magnitude of 17 people dead from gunfire at that school. But the fact is that this becomes a media story because of the way the students really turned things around. Instead of turning inward, as has happened in many previous shootings, these kids sent their force outward in a big way.
Well, I think it's significant that we're actually talking about it still today, right? As we talked about, the news cycle is changing constantly. And the general response to any mass shootings these days is that it's out of the news within a week. And so the fact that we're still talking about this really shows that something has changed, and it's changed because of these students and the way that they are using and utilizing especially social media, but also, of course, going on mainstream media as well. I think, you know, I've seen people kind of say, well, how is this happening? You know, how are these students able to keep this news story going? And I saw someone else say, well, they finally came after the social media generation. You know, this is a generation that was raised on how to communicate on social media. And so they're using that kind of inherent skill to kind of take over the conversation.
Which may have done to get them out there in the first place, but the fact is they also made themselves available to traditional media. They were all over the place on all TV news.
Yeah, and one thing that was really interesting was the way in which they also used their own social media and text messages to show the fear and the experiences that they were having as the event was happening. Dimitri Hoth, he showed the different types of group texts that were happening while they were like hiding in the classroom. So that was something that I think really communicated what it feels like in real time.
Yeah, I saw, I can't remember which student, but you know, there was a student who recorded kind of cell phone video interviews with students while they were hiding in the rooms, right? And so again, I think we're getting an insight into this experience in a way that we haven't seen before. I mean, it's tragic that it's taken this, but I think it's kind of been amazing to watch these students. I mean, I think we as teachers, right? These are the kinds of students we're getting ready to get to teach.
Right, you know,
they're graduating. So yeah. I mean, I hope, you know, this makes me excited about the kind of student we might be working with in the coming years. If this is not just one unique school, but if this is a generation of students who are really ready to use the tools they've been given to kind of make arguments and back those arguments up and to really enter into public debate. That's exciting.
That one student, Emma Gonzalez, she just was so powerful through all of the media and her public speaking and like fighting through the tears as she spoke. And
Very powerful.
Really felt she became like a household name in her, the way she reached out.
Yeah, the level of fearlessness, I guess. I mean, on one hand, they were being totally upfront about their fears, as we just talked about with texting what it was like to be in hiding as the shooter worked through the school, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, but also then overcoming, just pushing through the fear and the grief they clearly felt to be able to, because they felt it was important to get a message out there.
Yeah, they were so articulate through all their different media channels and really showing that, you know, we're not going to like just let this conversation end. It has to have some type of outcome.
Yeah, I watched the town hall that came, you know, almost immediately after it. And, you know, what was amazing to me is like, you know, person after person after person got up and spoke to, you know, relatively powerful people, and spoke with confidence and, you know, clearly they were prepared. And I'm sitting there, like, every time they start talking, I'm like breaking down in tears, like, how are they able to get together? Which I guess is, you know, part of what's prompted sort of this conspiracy theory that they're crisis actors and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's, again, tragic that people feel the need to, you know, tear down victims of a, you know, horrible tragedy, that, you know, call them crisis actors or fakes or conspiracy theories, all of that. But I think, you know, again, one thing you got to remember is that people process grief in very different ways. These are kids, you know, as exciting as it is to watch them be leaders, they also, you know, they aren't even fully processing their trauma yet too. So, I mean, I think we have to recognize that there's going to be moments where they're probably going to break up a little bit. They're going to fall apart a little bit. They're going to make social media mistakes. And I think they need to be given room to do that as they are young.
And they are human.
And they're human. Yeah.
Signals and Noise is our regular media segment here on the Jefferson Exchange. Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi teach communications classes at Southern Oregon University. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Let's move to more Washington-centric stuff. And Sam Nunberg, a former Trump campaign aide, who I guess was fired sometime in the late summer, early fall of 2015, was on a media blitz a couple of days ago after he got a subpoena from the special counsel. And it's hard to describe. I think you might have watched more of it. Why don't you take a peek?
Yeah, I never seen anything like it. I didn't know who Sam Nunberg was. I'd read his name at some point before, but you know, it was news to me. I just saw it popping up on Twitter and started clicking on videos. And again, I'd never seen anything like it. And so, you know, basically, Sam Nunberg got a subpoena to both appear before the special counsel and to produce emails connected to numerous people involved in the Trump campaign. And essentially, he decided to go on various media outlets saying that he wasn't going to go. He was not going to obey the subpoena. He wasn't going to provide the documents. Mueller could arrest him if he wanted to. And then he just, like, he was kind of, in some ways, nonsensical. I mean, he was saying, at the one hand, there was no collusion, but actually, well, maybe Carter Page did do collusion. And, like, you know, I think he does have something on Trump, but Trump didn't do anything. He was kind of giving conflicting statements. At one point, one CNN anchor who had, you know, he did some of the interviews in via phone, but
somewhere.
Tell me, he was in the studio, and at one point, one said, "You know, have you been drinking?" And he's like, "No, I haven't been drinking." And she said, "Well, I can smell alcohol on your breath." And I think since then, there's been a statement released that he had possibly been intoxicated in some way and is seeking help. And he has also complied with the subpoena now, and it also said that he provided all the documents and it actually wasn't as onerous as he thought it was going to be. But yeah, it was interesting, and there's also a debate about what are the media ethics there, right? That if someone is clearly having a mental breakdown or, you know, potentially drunk, should they, you know, is there an ethical obligation not to put them on the air? But then other people saying, look, here's someone who has insight into this investigation, and he's willing to say whatever he wants, and he's an adult, and he's responsible for that. So I think that was a really kind of interesting news case, because literally, I mean, reporters who were like B-level reporters were texting, "I just got a call from Sam Nunberg." Like, he was calling everyone. He was on like C-SPAN 4. It was ridiculous.
Oh, wow.
He was ubiquitous on the media. It was amazing how he was able to be in so many places at so many times. And when the reporter asked about if he had been drinking, his response also was that he hadn't taken his meds, too.
Which, again, raised sort of ethical questions. I mean, he even said, I haven't spoken to my lawyer yet. And he was asking, like, Katie Turr for legal advice. And he asked Jake Tapper, well, would you comply with the subpoena? He's like, well, if it was me, yeah, I would.
And every place he was on, he had that paper in his hand, too, which was weird because he was – it's strange to see a guest always – like carrying a paper to every
All
right, so let's flip this back then. I mean, if you're counseling students in your classes, you know, if somebody comes to you and it seems like they're having a little trouble keeping a grip on reality, but they're great news, where do you draw the line in whether to put them on the air or not?
Oh boy. I mean, I think I would approach it more cautiously, certainly with students. You know, if a student were in that situation, my argument would be err on the side of kind of humanity and saying, you know, I'm not gonna use this source. This source is not making rational decisions right now. You know, but if you're CNN and you have the legal department of CNN and this is the biggest news story in America, you know, I don't know. I mean, I have mixed feelings about it myself.
Yeah, it is definitely a corner of the story about what's going on at the White House, which brings us then to one of the other media issues this week, which is about Kellyanne Conway being on TV talking about people should vote against Doug Jones in Alabama or Roy Moore, whichever it was she sent. She was found in two counts of violation of the Hatch Act by an oversight body in Washington.
Well, by the special counsel's office. Mm-hmm. And this is actually the second and third case, because there had been a prior the ethics office had advised Kellyanne Conway for pushing Ivanka Trump's fashion line on an early interview when the administration just started, I think. And so the White House said that she had been counseled on that. And now the special prosecutor or special counsel's office released a statement saying that that they had found that she had violated the Hatch Act, but that it was the purview of the president to discipline. And in this case, the White House counsel released a statement saying that no, she didn't violate the Hatch Act. No, we're not going to do anything about this. And
which raises the question too about the Hatch Act is supposed to keep people from doing overtly political things on government time and money, but the fact is the president can do it. So why can't one of his underlings do it?
Right, the president and the vice president are the two that are exempt. Thank you. Exempt from the Hatch Act, but all other executive employees are not supposed to do it. And the idea is that because they don't, the president and the vice president are sort of essentially political figures, but the rest of the government, they work for us. They are our employees. They, again, the president and the vice president are also our employees, but it's a little different.
Yeah, and so they're not so much using that platform to spread out their points of view.
Right.
All right. Interesting stuff from Washington. This is our Signals and Noise segment on the Jefferson Exchange. We're visiting with Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi of the Communications Faculty at Southern Oregon University. You're welcome to join the conversation by phone at 800-838-3760 about topics in the media, or jx@jeffnet.org. And here again, never a dull moment in the media business. You were just telling me, and I had a chance to look at this as we were getting seated here, about the Sinclair Broadcasting, which has come under fire in the past for having some must-run materials that are, they present a viewpoint. It's a conservative viewpoint. They own lots of local stations around the country, are trying to buy many more in combination with Tribune Broadcasting, or what was Tribune Broadcasting, and now has apparently sent out a must-read message to the anchors criticizing national news media.
Yeah, so the essentially they're asking their anchors to read on the air that Sinclair stations are proud of their balanced news reporting, that unfortunately there are those in the national media who are pushing fake news without fact checking. And I mean, I guess on the generous side, you could say, good, they're addressing people, telling people to check their sources. On the less generous side, it sounds a lot like what the White House has been saying about the national media. And so the question is, whose water are they carrying with this message? And apparently it came to CNN's attention because of some of the local stations being highly uncomfortable with the content of the message and feeling like they were being forced to share propaganda on the air. And so they wanted to expose it.
I was surprised that it's a sort of a lengthy message, too. It's not like a one or two sentence type of message that they quickly say on air. It's something that would get you to stop and pause and listen and really try and see what they're saying.
Now, these are not, I see, meant for within the newscast, but they're meant to be read as promos to run anywhere in the day parts of the station.
Yeah.
Read by the station anchors, and The Hill here quotes it directly. Unfortunately, some members of the national media are using their platforms to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think. This is extremely dangerous to our democracy. Which is interesting because, again, Sinclair does come from a viewpoint with the stuff that it requires its stations to run. I know this having talked to people who work at Sinclair stations. They are all around us. We have Sinclair Station in Medford, two in Eugene, one in Portland, one in Seattle. So many, many Sinclair stations around the country. And if there's an agreement to raise the ownership cap, there could be many more.
Yeah, I think, again, it just goes to show you that, people wonder why does media ownership matter? This is why it matters. You might be listening, you might think, these are my local, this is my local station. These reporters, these anchors, they live in my community. They represent my community. But, who's the owner of that station and what agenda do they have that they're forcing upon their employees?
We have another topic here raised by a listener. Donna and Ashland wrote in to talk about the lawsuit that it's the children's climate lawsuits that we've been talking about for a while. I know this is kind of out of left field for you guys. I'll just address it myself because we've had actually Kelsey Giuliani has been on the program, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit filed in Eugene. These are lawsuits filed against the government to obtain action on climate change. And Donna writes that there's been little media attention. The lawsuit is proceeding in federal courts, has global attention, even National Geographic. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it is out there. I did just see that another federal appeals court said, yes, the case can proceed to trial, which has been this on-again, off-again thing so far. So it has our attention, Donna. Thanks for bringing that back to our attention. Let's talk about something a little lighter. We can talk about the Oscars, although, you know, even the Oscars couldn't be particularly light this year, given the backdrop.
Yeah, I think that the positive side was that we did see representation of diversity in terms of the winners and the acts that were entertaining at the Oscars. I'm so happy for Guillermo del Toro, who's had such a long career in terms of his storytelling that definitely comes from such a unique point and perspective of his culture, but this influence of monsters and horror, but then the emotional side that monsters have feelings too.
It's basically The Creature from the Black Lagoon and a romance.
Yeah. It's Splash meets The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Right. So Shape of Water was the Oscar, rather, the best picture Oscar winner. While those Jimmy Kimmel went, you know, you got to realize that this will be known as the year when men in Hollywood screwed up so bad that we now have women dating fish.
Yeah. I think, you know, it was an interesting Oscar broadcast. I won the Oscar pool. I got 20 bucks and a box of chocolate. But you know, I think one of the interesting things, and I think Jimmy Kimmel did a fine job. It was odd to me though that, you know, the Oscars, given the moment, didn't reach out to a woman host. I think some of the best presenters were women, and kind of had the standout moments. You know, I think one of the biggest stories though out of the Oscars was the Frances McDormand's hashtag inclusion waiver writer. Yeah. Which a lot of people didn't know what that means. And essentially what that means is that stars can stand up and say they won't appear in a film unless the producers agree to make the cast, both the cast and crew, diverse. And we've already been seeing actors, stars come out and say, yep, I'm going to do this. So for instance, Michael B. Jordan, who's in the biggest movie in America right now, Black Panther, and is a major rising star and is going to be highly sought after in the business, said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do the inclusion waiver. And Emily Blunt, I think, was another one. So we're seeing major stars come out and say, yep, this is what I'm going to do. And so it's actually using, you know, a lot of stars will get up and give platitudes. And so I thought it was interesting that Frances McDormand gave legal advice, right? Saying there's actually a way, you have power. You can use, you know, your value as a star to make change happen.
So use your strength coming into the game. I mean, if you're a desired commodity, then
it's all about contract.
Yeah, it is indeed. There was also a Twitter ad that ran during the Oscars that got some attention. It was a minute long. I watched the whole thing yesterday.
Yeah, the hashtag here we are.
Here we are. I keep on saying we are here, but yeah, here we are.
It was, as Andrew had and I talked about it previously, that it was a type of ad that made people stop and really listen and see what was happening. It was also artfully done in terms of the black and white and the poetry and the representation of female CEOs and women in film.
Yeah, a wide variety. You know, I was at Oscar ad, and literally the room, Oscar party, and when that ad came up, the room went silent. Everybody was transferred. I've never seen that happen with a commercial before. And then we all kind of laughed at the end when the Twitter logo came up.
Right.
Because it was like, oh, it's a Twitter ad. And then, you know, I think it was, I mean, bravo to Twitter for doing it. But, you know, I saw a lot of response from women on Twitter saying, great ad, Twitter. Can you do something about the hundreds of men who are harassing me daily, who are giving me death threats, who are calling me words that I can't repeat on the air? So I think a lot of women felt like it was a bit of an empty gesture from Twitter, given their policies and how difficult it is to actually get people who are harassing them online banned.
Speaking of Twitter, just a quick second here on this point of view. Apparently you read an opinion piece at CNET about how if you retweet the stuff you disagree with, it amplifies the original post. So in other words, you're actually giving some traction to the thing you don't like.
Yeah, and not even just on Twitter, on Facebook, if you continue to share stories that you feel are like clickbait type of stories that, mm-hmm. you know, are just trying to get a lot of clicks or that are not well done, that you are amplifying this type of not so great journalism, or you're amplifying these really negative messages that then it's all shown in numbers.
So watch your rage, because you could be helping the
yeah, I think that's why a lot of savvy Twitter users will do, like, if they're trying to call out a bad story or something, they'll do a screen grab and post that as a picture and say, you know, this article is, you know, problematic or whatever. So they're not giving it the retweet. Yeah. They're instead showing the image.
Okay. About 2 minutes to get pick three from the two of you. Precious, why don't you start?
Yeah. I'll do a YouTube channel called Strictly Dumpling by this Asian man who travels all around the world and eats the best type of food, and I don't know how he stays in shape, but it's really, really, really wonderful.
Strictly Dumpling, okay.
Yes, and then there's also an Instagram channel that I love to follow, Margaret Zhang. She's an Chinese Australian woman who's, I think she was originally a model, but she's now a photographer, and she puts out really great media content in terms of her travels and awareness of different cultures. And then I don't know how I could have lived without some of the Cirque Des Soleil acrobats who uh-huh. have Instagrams. One of them is Kia Melinda Eastman, and I just love seeing all of the behind the scenes practice that goes into the Cirque Des Soleil events. And it's kind of one of those channels that you could watch for like 20 minutes before you fall asleep okay. and look at all their practice.
Strictly Dumpling, Margaret Zhang, and Cirque du Soleil on Instagram. Andrew, you're
right, so for my first is Flint Town, a new docuseries that just premiered on Netflix on Friday. It is produced by Gary Kaut, a resident of Ashland, and it's a great series about the policing of Flint. My second is one I haven't seen yet, but I'm planning on, is A Wrinkle in Time, premieres this weekend. I've been reading my daughter's the book, so I'm excited to see Ava DuVernay's interpretation of that. And then last of all, I'll say tonight from I think around 6 to 9 I'm going to be on SOP TV. Southern Oregon Film and Media is sort of sponsoring the pledge drive tonight, and so a lot of local filmmakers will be sort of on there answering phones, and I'm going to be doing something, I'm not sure what,
okay.
but I'll
Andrew
be there.
And A Wrinkle in Time and Flint Town on Netflix. All right, good sets of pick threes. Good to see you both here once again on the Jefferson Exchange. We can talk off air about how many times we have seen Black Panther among us. Signals and Noise monthly on the Jefferson Exchange. Andrew Gay, Precious Yamaguchi, thank you as always.
Thank you.